The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
It is one thing to think of that which is inalienable.
As being exercised in its normal condition. It's another thing altogether to think of it as being exercised in the utterly abnormal condition. Sin has brought a moral agent, if I may use that term, or a human person, if I may use that term, is never in the proper exercise of the agency, the specific agency that belongs to him. Is exercised in the whole-souled love of and service to God. Whole-souled love of God and the service of God. There is another way that we might describe personality. We could think of personality as being endowed with understanding, feeling, and will. That's another perspective from which we may view personality. That man is spirit, and that spirit is inconceivable apart from the exercise of understanding, feeling, and will. That spirit is inconceivable apart from the exercises of understanding, feeling, and will. Spirit, of course, has been, but it is never simply a substance. Never to be conceived of as substance. There is activity belonging to the very conception of the human spirit. And so, as long as man is spirit, he has intellect, feeling, and will, but we must always remember that his understanding, his intellect, is darkened, his affections and emotions are perverted, his will is enslaved, his conscience is distorted. So that man's moral agency, so inalienable, is nevertheless so diverted and perverted from its proper end and purpose that his personality
his very personality must be conceived of as depraved. We can never isolate the metaphysical from the moral relations in which that metaphysical stands. That is, when we're thinking of man's metaphysics, we can never isolate the metaphysical from the moral relations in which that metaphysical stands, and the moral obligations to God which are entailed in the relation man's metaphysical being. Moral relations which are entailed in his metaphysical being as personality. Now, just before I start on this particular page and discussion, one other question. And that is, what of the body of man? What of man as body? It would be very easy to say, wouldn't it, that man is in the image of God simply and solely because he is spirit. Man is made in the image of God, and therefore man is spirit. And thus, we would exclude the body of man from the scope of the divine image. Another consideration would be that God does not have a body. And if God does not have a body, then the image of God must refer exclusively to the spirit of man. That is the pattern of thought that has been followed by a good many in the discussion of this question. And that only as respects man's soul or spirit can we speak of him as in the image of God. Personally, I don't believe that thesis is tenable. However plausible it may seem to be, on the basis of these considerations which I have just mentioned, we now turn to what we were dealing with at the close of the last hour, and the question was whether the human body is embraced within the divine image. And I mentioned as the first consideration in favor of that position that it is man as a unit who is spoken of when God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness." If the image of God refers to human personality, as I maintain. If the image of God refers to human personality, we must remember that according to the biblical representation,
the human body is an integral part of human personality. And the separation that takes place in death is utterly abnormal. Utterly abnormal. And therefore there is a consideration residing in the fact of human personality and in the unity of human personality by which we would be constrained, at least we should be constrained, to regard the human body as brought within the scope of that which is referred to as the image of God. But then there is a second consideration supporting this same conclusion. Of the human body is predicated, or are predicated, righteousness and holiness, as well as sin and impurity. That is to say, the human body is the subject of moral predication. Moral predication. Man in his fallen state has a body of sin. Romans 6:6. A body of sin, and that means a sinful body.
Consequently, that predication could not be made.
And as moral character belongs to the body, and if the thesis I have presented is correct, it is because man has moral identity that he is in the image of God. So I conclude that it is man in his unity and integrity who is made in the image of God. And that therefore the very body of man is determined in its precise character and functions by the fact that man is made in the image of God. We must remember, you see, that man as body has distinguishing character from every other being that is body, or that is bodily. He has distinguishing character. And the only reason why he has this distinguishing character is that his very identity is defined in terms of the image of God. See, that his very identity is defined in terms of the image of God.
Now don't deduce from that fact that God has a body
or anything resembling a body.
We must remember that there is a radical differentiation between God and man, even in respect of spiritual being. A radical differentiation in respect even of spiritual being. And there is still further radical differentiation in respect of man as body. But that difference that obtains in respect of man's body is simply another example of the radical differentiation which applies even to the spirit of man. Well, that is all on that subject of the first aspect of the divine and all this personality. Morally, now we come to the second aspect, according to the position I propounded. This refers to moral excellence. Referring to those characteristics which belong to man in his original integrity, but which do not belong to him in his fallen state. And they are briefly after the pattern of Ephesians 4:24 and Colossians 3:10, knowledge, righteousness, and holiness of the truth. Knowledge, righteousness, and holiness of the truth. If knowledge is predicated of man in his original state, we must not think of this as consisting merely in the possibility of attaining to knowledge. If knowledge is an ingredient, then it means the intelligent apprehension of the meaning of reality. It means that the cognitive content of man's mind corresponded with reality. Cognitive content of his mind corresponded with reality. And that simply means that it was knowledge of the truth. And the truth preeminently as it belongs to God. So he had the knowledge of God. This does not mean that it was complete knowledge. Knowledge commensurate with the knowledge of God, man will never possess that knowledge. But incomplete knowledge is still knowledge. Measures up to that which our Lord characterizes as life. Then also righteousness means not simply freedom from wrongdoing, not mere innocence, but positive conformity to the will of God. Positive conformity to the will of God. Applying not only the disposition to, but the fulfillment of God's revealed will. And holiness can be construed as comprising two elements, namely consecration and purity. Consecration and purity. When we say that man was created with righteousness and holiness of the truth, we mean that he was created with positively holy and righteous character, positively holy and righteous character. And did not need to achieve, to attain to that character by a process of development. But that this character was concreated investiture or a concreated endowment. That is clearly implied in Genesis 1:31 as it applies to man. Genesis 1:31 says that God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good, very good. Including, of course, man. And that predication as it applies to man, very good, must be given a connotation that is relevant to his distinguishing and specific character. I repeat, must be given a connotation that is relevant to his distinguishing and specific character as a moral and religious being. This general statement means that each creature was very good in terms of the sphere, in terms of the sphere to which it belonged, and in terms of the purpose it was called upon to fulfill. The sphere to which man belongs, of course, is the highest sphere of created reality. Consequently, the definition of very good as it applies to him requires no lower definition than knowledge, righteousness, and holiness of the truth. For only in terms of these characterizations could he be pronounced very good. Yes?
This is the phrase, knowledge, righteousness, and holiness of the truth. Does of the truth refer only to holiness or to all three?
Well, whatever it may refer to in the particular text, you see, that's a matter of possible difference of opinion. I think it does refer to both righteousness and holiness in that particular text. But even if in the strict exegesis of that passage it refers only to holiness, nevertheless, we on general principles would have to apply to all three. Because the knowledge that measures up to what the scripture describes as knowledge is never knowledge unless it's knowledge of the truth. And righteousness is never true righteousness unless it is righteousness that is in conformity with truth. So whatever particular exegesis would require of that text, nevertheless, it's proper to extend that word, that phrase of the truth, to all three. Now I come to an appendix to our discussion respecting the image of God, or man in the image of God. And this has respect to dominion over the creature. Dominion over the creature. The Socinians, heretical sect of the time of the Reformation, the Socinians restricted the divine image to dominion over the creatures. Now, it would be quite erroneous to make that restriction. And I don't need to enumerate all the grounds on the basis of which that position would have to be pronounced as erroneous. But even Orthodox theologians would take the position that dominion of the creatures is to be regarded as an ingredient in the divine image. So they would list it as number three, as an ingredient in the divine image, as an element of the divine image. There are two things to be said about that position. First, it would not involve any serious error as far as theology is concerned. It involved any serious theological error to regard it as an element in the divine image. The second thing I have to say about that position is that there are certain passages which might seem to convey this idea. That the dominion is to be reckoned as part, at least, of the image of God. Take Psalm 8, for example. Psalm 8. What is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou visitest him? Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels. Thou hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou hast put all things under his feet, sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, so on. Well, that psalm is dealing, you see, specifically with the dominion with which man is invested.
The commentary on that psalm, Hebrews 2, makes that very clear.
The theme of that psalm, of course, is, as far as man is concerned, the dignity that belongs to him in virtue of his domain. I shouldn't say that is the theme of the psalm, because the theme of the psalm really is how excellent is the name of the Lord. But as far as man is concerned, it is his domain that is reflected and the dignity that belongs to him in virtue of that investiture. Now, it might seem, therefore, that dominion is in view in the very definition of man. Because the psalmist asks, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Or the son of man that thou visitest him? See, it would be very easy, you see, to infer that this dominion belongs to man's very definition. Because it is with that question that the lyric echo of man's creation begins. What is man? Thou art mindful of him. Or the son of man that thou visitest. Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, or if you will, a little lower than God. Thou hast crowned him with glory and honor. And the other passage, which might appear to give some plausible support to the idea that the image is to be defined in terms of the authority which belongs to man is 1 Corinthians 11:7. Because Paul there, you see, is dealing with the authority with which the man, as distinguished from the woman, is invested. The authority that belongs to him. And it is in that connection that he says, the man is the image and glory of God. And ikon, if your members used there. The man is the image and glory of God. Now these considerations could be pleaded in support of the thesis that dominion over the creatures must in some way or other be comprised in what is regarded as the image of God. Man is the image of God. However, I must say with respect to this question, though it isn't a question that is of what you would call vital theological concern, what I would say about this is that the relevant evidence would not favor the inference that dominion is an aspect of the divine image. And it is an aspect of the divine image. When you go back to Genesis 1:26 through 28. Genesis 1:26 through 28. You are given a very different perspective in respect of the relation of dominion to the image of God. Genesis 1:26. You remember. And God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion, let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the heaven, and over the cattle, and over everything of the earth, and over all the creeping thing which creeps upon the earth. And God created the man in his image, in his image, in the image of God created he him. And then I just pass over to verse 28. At the latter part of the verse, this is a command directed to man, and exercise dominion and rule over, literally, and exercise dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the heaven, and over every living creature which creeps upon the earth. Now, this representation which you have in Genesis 1, 26 through 28, is to the effect that since man is created in the image of God, he is to exercise this dominion. That the dominion is something which rests upon and proceeds from his being made in the image of God. That is to say, dominion is regarded as a function, as a duty, as a duty that man is to perform. In other words, the sequence would be much more naturally taken as follows. The input, I should say, of the sequence would naturally be taken as follows. Man is made in the image of God. God, because he is God, is sovereign over that which he has created. God, since he is God, is sovereign over that which he has created. Man, in turn, since he is in the image of God, is God's vicegerent upon earth. That is to say, he is given a dominion which is patterned after the dominion which God exercises. But since this dominion which God exercises doesn't define his Godhood, but is a necessity arising from his God, so the dominion which man exercises is not the definition of his manhood, but
a function which he necessarily exercises in virtue of his manner. Doesn't define his manner, but it is a function which he necessarily exercises because of his manner. And his manner is defined in terms of the image of God. You can find the very same sequence in Psalm 8 and in 1 Corinthians 11:7. Same sequence. These psalms is certainly reflecting upon the dignity which belongs to man. Dignity that belongs to man. But that dignity that belongs to him and is expressed in the dominion that he exercises need, according to the law, to be defined in terms of the dominion. It is perfectly compatible with the sequence of Psalm 8. Perfectly compatible. To regard the dominion. Dominion reflected upon. As a function which illustrates and certifies. Illustrates and certifies the dignity which belongs to his nature, belongs to his being. And likewise in 1 Corinthians 11:7, it does not say that the image consists in the authority with which man is invested. And consist in the authority with which man is invested. And so it is perfectly compatible with the thought of that passage. To recognize the authority with which the man is invested. Something correlative with the authority with which the man is invested, as something correlative with he is being the image and glory of God, but is correlative with he's being the image and glory of God. This does not mean God is, are to be defined in terms of his dominion, correlativity does not mean identity or equation. We must remember that the uniform with respect to dominion, the uniform representation is
that it is a function or office to be executed. A function or office to be executed. It is a duty which man is commanded to fulfill. Commanded to fulfill. Now these two considerations, namely that it is a function to be executed and a duty to be fulfilled, do not comport, that is, do not agree, do not comport with the idea that it belongs to the image of God. But is rather a function and an obligation devolving upon him because he is made in the image of God. Because he is made in the image of God. No, that's my viewpoint with respect to dominion. Want to include it as an element in the image of God, I shall not explode. That's my apologia for the position I take.
Professor Morris?
Yes?
What did you say then, that is not serious matter in the theology, in the theology of the theology is concerned? That is serious matter in the theology.
No, I don't think so. Something may be exegetically untenable and yet not involve a basic theological error. If you were to suppose that the image of God is comprised exclusively in the dominion, well, that would be a serious error. But I wouldn't characterize the viewpoint that it is a subordinate element in the divine image, subordinate element as involving any serious theological error. I don't think any theological principle would be at stake. That's all. There are certain things which deviate from what you would call sound exegesis, but which nevertheless do not involve basic theological error. Of course, all deviation from sound exegesis is error, but there are differing degrees of error. And all I would say is this does not involve basic theological does not involve principles that are detrimental to theology as a whole. Would make a great deal of difference so long as you recognize the primacy of the first two elements, especially of the first element. Well, now I'm going to pass on to the various views. Various views with respect to the image of God. It is more accurate at this point to use the designation man's primitive condition, differing views of man's primitive condition. It so happens that especially with respectable kind of view that is a more felicitous caption. It concerns much more than the view of that in which the language exists. You bear that in mind, because if I should ever ask you a question in an examination, give the effect of the Roman Catholic view of man's primitive condition, you'll understand what I'm getting at. It wouldn't be so accurate to call it the Roman Catholic view of man in the limited thought, because it involves far more than that. That is only a subordinate aspect of the view, and the same concerns the Lutheran view and the classic Reformed view and so on, and the Pelagian view. So this caption is a little more accurate and more felicitous at this particular point. Now, we take up, first of all, the Roman Catholic view. The Roman Catholic view of man's primitive condition. And I'm going to deal with that under four, play the bell with some, four main captions. The Roman Catholic view under four main captions. Might get expanded to five before I'm finished, but you'll have to be satisfied with four just now. And you just have to put these down now so that you'll know where I'm going. And the first, I'm going to put down Latin terms, the state of pure nature that the Roman Catholic Church teaches respecting the state of pure nature. It's a literal translation. State of pure nature. Then the second would be what Roman Catholic Church teaches about the conflict. And maybe the final term is Pugna Concupis Centia. Concupis Centiae. And then you have the third, the Dona Superadita. And then you have the Imago Dei, the image of God. No doubt you often hear about the Donum Superadito, don't you? Donum Superadito. It's really not strictly accurate to speak of the Roman Catholic doctrine of the Donum Superadito. You have to use a plural. Dona Superadita. Bear that in mind. Superadded gifts. Because Roman Catholic theology today does not speak of adonum superadditum, but of dona superadita. The older Roman Catholic theology would speak about donum, but the present-day Roman Catholic theology is very jealous for distinctions here. And they speak about dona superadita, superadded gifts. That is not a singular, remember. Donum is a neuter, and dona this refers to the image of God. Now, we'll begin with the first point, which is the state of pure nature. Well, there's no purpose in my beginning, because the bell will ring in a moment.
Today, October 16th. Wednesday, 1963.
Now the woman has this position respecting man's primitive condition, and first of all we have what they themselves, the Roman Catholics, call the state of pure nature. The state of pure nature. That man was created at the beginning of soul and body. That is, of two distinct and diverse elements. The one with corporeal impulses and desires, and the other with the higher exercises of reason, conscience, and will. This primitive condition, this condition which arose from God's original creative act, is one in which man is endowed simply with natural gifts. With natural gifts. Dona naturalia. And it is called in Roman Catholic theology a state of impuris naturalibus. Impuris naturalibus. Susceptible. Convenient translation. Other than to say in a state of pure nature. Impuris naturalibus. This state is one in which man possesses all the attributes necessary to his nature as man. But destitute of those graces which adorn human nature. Destitute of those graces which adorn human nature. This condition is one in which there is concupiscence. But this concupiscence is not sinful. It isn't sinful. It is simply a state in which there are these diverse appetites and impulses. Diverse appetites and impulses. Arising from the diverse constituents of his metaphysical being. Sensuous appetites and impulses arising from the corporeal, and higher exercises of reason, arising from the spiritual. There can be no fault attaching to this concupiscence because it is not a diversity that arises from the will of man. But proceeds from the very constitution with which man was created. Now we come to Romans 2, which I have called the pugna concupiscentiae, the conflict arising from concupiscence. Conflict arising from concupiscence. Although this state of nature is not one of sin, it is nevertheless one in which there is a tendency on the part of the lower impulses to break through the limits of reason. A tendency to break through the limits of reason. And when they do break through the limits of reason, then you have the concupiscence of the flesh, which is sinful. Concupiscence of the flesh, which is sinful. Now, in many Roman Catholic theologians, this tendency is not construed to be more than tendency. But in some of the ablest and most representative of Romish theologians, it is construed as a conflict between the lower and higher elements in man's nature. Conflict, which would inevitably develop by degrees. Because of the composite nature of man's being. You'll find a quotation from Bellarmine on page 104 of the textbook, which is very, very clear to this effect. He calls it a fight, a battle, a conflict. And I'll translate that paragraph. It's at the middle of page 104. It must be understood, first of all, that man naturally consists of flesh and spirit. And therefore, partly with the beasts and partly with the angels, has affinity of nature, has a common nature. Partly with the beasts and partly with the angels, has a common nature. And therefore, by reason of the flesh and affinity with the beasts, with the other animate beings, of course, affinity with the beasts, he has a certain propension to corporal good. Corporal good. And sensible good in sense of, not sensible, you know, sense of the word, but pertaining to the senses. Perhaps corporal and sensuous good be the best translation. Towards which he is borne along by sense and appetite. By reason of the spirit and affinity with the angels, he has a propension to spiritual and intellectual good, to spiritual and rational good, towards which he is born by intelligence and will. Now here's the insignificant statement. But from these two diverse or contrary propensions, from these two diverse and contrary propensions, there exists in the one and the same man a certain fight, a certain conflict, a certain battle, pugnam quandam. A certain battle, and from this conflict, still battle, and from this conflict, an inherent difficulty of doing what is good, while one propension hinders the other. There exists in one and the same man a certain fight, and from that fight, an inherent difficulty of doing good, as long as the one propension hinders the other. Bellarmine is quite representative on that, because Thomas Aquinas, much earlier than Bellarmine, about three centuries earlier, took the very same position. He used this term, pugna. Well, so much for that. Now we come to third. The superadded gifts. Dona superadded. Whether this condition of concupiscence is regarded as simply tendency or as actual conflict, it created the necessity for the bestowal of the dona superadditor. In In older Roman Catholic theology, this is spoken of as donum superadditum, as the superadded gift. And it is called original righteousness, justitia originalis, original righteousness. And the purpose of this supernatural or superadded grace is that the sensual and supersensual, the sensual and supersensual elements in man's being were maintained in harmony, the one with the other. By this gift of original righteousness, according to the older formulation, by this gift of original righteousness, man was brought into the closest communion with his Creator. Into the closest communion with his Creator. And man was exalted above human nature and made to participate in the nature of God. Made to participate in the nature of God. It is important to bear in mind that this gift is due to special grace on God's part. Due to special grace. What Müller calls a special condescension of the Almighty. God was under no obligation whatsoever to endow man with this added grace. It is therefore superadded and supernatural. But more recent, that goes back quite a long time, close to 100 years, in more recent Roman Catholic theology, these superadded gifts, dona superaddita, are divided into preternatural and supernatural gifts. Preternatural and supernatural. Preternatural and supernatural. And what the older Roman Catholic theology called supernatural this Roman Catholic theology calls preternatural. And of these preternatural gifts there are two. Namely, immortality and integrity. Immortality, integrity. Now, this preternatural own superadded gift of immortality was necessary in order to free man from the necessity of dying, deliver man from the necessity of dying. Roman Catholic theology is explicit in teaching that death is a necessity. Inherently, the corporeal nature of man. Necessity inherently is corporeal nature. Hence, if man were to be immortal, this required a superadded grace, superadded gift. The second preternatural gift is that of integrity. Integrity. And that refers to the harmony established between the component elements of man's nature. The harmony between the component elements of man's nature. It is this integrity that overcomes the conflict existing in the state of pure nature between the corporeal and the spiritual. Now, the supernatural is to be carefully distinguished from the preternatural. And this is called sanctity, sanctitas, sanctity, sanctitas. By this supernatural grace, man was made a partaker of the divine nature. Elevated to a higher order of existence. Endowed with that which is above the essence and exigency of any created nature. Exigency and this need of any created nature, adopted into the position occupied by the only begotten Son, and given the capacity for the beatific vision. The beatific vision, given the capacity for the beatific vision.